Hello, I'm Amanda Kelly. This is number 0144, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0144. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Adria Vassell, who is the author of Ecoholic Body. There are toxins all around us and even in us. Today, kids are born with toxins already in them.
They tested umbilical cords to see how many trace pollutants were in them and found up to 358 chemical compounds in umbilical cord blood. Everything from flame retardants to stain repellents, you know, non-stick chemicals, antibacterial chemicals, the list went on.
Edward G. Berenson is the author of The Statue of Liberty, The Transatlantic Story. How did America end up getting a statue from France?
There was an effort on the part of some French dissidents to criticize their government. They had a hard time speaking out in public because there was so much censorship. And so what they wanted to do was to compare their dictatorship with what they considered to be a much better government, the United States government. And they wanted to do that by offering a gift to the United States that would emphasize American liberty as opposed to what they believed was French tyranny.
Edward Mayer from Ripley's Believe It or Not talks about their new book, Unbelievable Stories for Guys.
I think that these are stories for anybody who doesn't necessarily like to read novels. They're short, one paragraph, two pages at absolute most stories that are all unbelievable, all true, but not necessarily all new. This book is a little different than our other books in that it really represents a best of Ripley's.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0144, was Amanda Kelly, the online web producer at Global Montreal, the other place that I work. And thank you very much, Amanda, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. The Stuff File program is heard many places, including Stitcher Smart Radio, the smart way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Now, have you ever noticed that the craziest people always seem to be naked? Police in Bloomington, Indiana, had a rude awakening when they got two calls around 7 a.m., one saying that a naked man was screaming and setting off fireworks, and another reporting that the nudist was firing bullets into the back of a house. When police arrived, they found the suspect quite naked indeed, and waving and shooting a 9mm handgun. There are just some places you don't want to have powder burns. Anyway, after making the grave mistake of pointing the gun at the officers, he was shot and wounded twice by police. Per a police statement, multiple shell casings from a 9mm firearm had been recovered from gunshots fired by the suspect prior to the arrival of officers. Initial damage has been noted to three vehicles and the back door of the residence of the second caller. Neighbors took plenty of photos, which are, of course, now all over the internet. You usually don't have to worry about naked people reloading. You know, there's nowhere to keep the ammo. Anyway, put your dang cell phone down already. That's my tip of the day. That's also what the state of New Jersey is saying to pedestrians. Fort Lee, New Jersey police are going to crack down on those who text while walking against traffic lights or who wander into traffic while listening to blaring music on their iPod. Fort Lee Police Chief Thomas Ripley says it's a big distraction. Pedestrians aren't watching where they're walking. They're not aware. Some Fort Lee residents are up in arms about the new crackdown, and many feel the $85 fine is excessive. But we might point out that the initiative only went into effect after more than 20 Fort Lee pedestrians were hit by cars just this year in Fort Lee. Now, it's the idea that so many people are up in arms over this that gets me. That's the part that I find rather amusing. I can't tell you the amount of people who, thankfully, when I'm stopped at a traffic light, actually bounce off my car because they're not paying attention when they cross the street. I just sit there wondering why there isn't an open manhole or a banana peel when you really need one. Anyway, talk about grace under pressure. Nikolai Popov fell 160 feet down a crevasse while backcountry skiing near Whistler Resort in British Columbia. Not only did he walk away with no injuries, he took pictures while down there in the crevasse and documented his rescue. Fortunately, he was skiing with a partner who went for help. A helicopter arrived after just a little over 2 hours and had just enough room to lower a rope and pull him to safety among collapsing chunks of frozen snow. It's not hard to imagine how this story would have ended had Popov been skiing alone. Gee, I wonder if he was texting while he was skiing. Anyway, and it seems like you can get almost anything at Walmart, but you're not supposed to be able to get rattlesnakes. In Clarkston, Washington, 47-year-old Micah Craig is recovering after he was bitten by a rattlesnake in a Walmart superstore's garden department. Micah says the rattlesnake attacked him as he reached down to brush away what he thought was a stick from a bag of mulch. He quickly stamped on the reptile and was later treated at hospital with antivenom after his hand suffered some serious swelling. Micah was unusually calm about the whole thing, maybe because his purchases were intended for his marijuana plants, which he is licensed to grow for medical reasons. Walmart apologized and said it was going to investigate just how the snake had gotten into the store. Walmart apologized. Isn't that lovely? Dude, you better hook the guy up with some serious gift cards before he goes out and hires himself one hotshot lawyer. That's all I have to say about that. And we have time for one more story in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our first guest with me, Peter Anthony Holder. In Luxor, Egypt, the funeral of a 28-year-old waiter was turned suddenly into a celebration when the guy woke up after being declared dead. Hospital officials had pronounced Hamdi Hafez al-Nubi dead after he suffered a heart attack while working. Grieving relatives took him home, as per Islamic tradition, washed his body, and prepared him for burial. But a doctor sent to sign the death certificate found it strange that his body was still warm. At closer observation, she discovered that he was still alive. His mother fainted upon hearing the good news. With the doctor's assistance, both al-Nubi and his mother were awakened and soon were celebrating with guests. You know, sometimes you have to wonder if the guy's death was merely wishful thinking on the part of the family. I mean, they were so eager and quick to have him pronounced dead. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, on to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. There are various pollutants that are hiding in everything from our sinus meds to sunscreen. So are you making the right choice when it comes to the products that you use that are supposed to take care of us? Adria Vassil is an ambassador for green living and the best-selling author of Ecoholic and Ecoholic Home. Her latest book is Ecoholic Body, and she joins us on the line right now from Toronto. Hi, Adria.
Hi there.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
My pleasure.
I saw you recently on a television interview, and one of the first things I heard you mention, or one of the first things that was discussed, was the idea that there are a certain amount of pollutants or toxins that are in umbilical cords?
Yes, I hate to have to share some bad news, but they tested umbilical cords to see how many trace pollutants were in them and found up to 358 chemical compounds in umbilical cord blood. Everything from flame retardants to stain repellents, non-stick chemicals, antibacterial chemicals, the list went on.
Okay, now that's just very, very scary. We start life behind the eight ball, it sounds like.
You know what? I mean, it's just a sign that we all grew up in a polluted world. I think it's kind of a sign that we're living in a global village and all this pollution that's swirled around the planet really gets into all of us. And whether you're a newborn baby or you're a polar bear in the Arctic Circle, we are all born polluted to a certain extent. Now, I'm very clear to say that, you know, these are trace pollutants. It doesn't mean we're all going to keel over tomorrow, but it is a sign that there's just too much junk in the world, and we do need to try and reduce it wherever we can.
On a totally unrelated question, topic, and I don't even know if you're have discussed this or even qualified to bring it up, but the idea of so many toxins in our system at birth, you know, we hear a lot of stories about some of the situations that are happening with children that are born these days, higher numbers of diseases and situations. Could they be related?
Well, you know, I have a section in my book on environmental health, and, you know, I do talk about the fact that we are surrounded by thousands of officially known or possible or suspected carcinogens, you know, cancer-linked ingredients, as well as hormone disruptors, you know, that all might have an impact on the human body. And yet, you know, the concept of them actually causing health problems is still controversial. But, you know, when you're talking about the fact that we're so surrounded by these chemicals, and the fact that other governments around the world are taking a stand on many of these, then, you know, I don't think we should be surprised that some of these chemicals are potentially causing health problems down the road. And people are linking them to things like infertility, you know, why more people are going to, you know, for help getting pregnant. They're linked to, you know, more obvious problems like lung health and asthma and allergies, as well as things like cancer and, you know, even ADHD in children. And so, yeah, we, you know, scientists are now starting to make those links, and it does raise some pretty worrisome questions.
So let's talk about some of the things in body care, and more importantly, is there a possible way of getting that genie back in the bottle?
Oh, yeah. So I am a big proponent of controlling the pollutants that we can get a grip on, and you know, I myself got tested for pollutants and found that, okay, there's some things I can't control, like where I grew up when I was a kid, I'm going to have certain pollutants from that. But there are a lot of chemicals that I can control thanks to, you know, the choices that we can make when we go to the store and choose more body and planet safe natural products. And so there's one ingredient out there right now that's really on my hit list, and that is triclosan or triclosan, T-R-I-C-L-O-S-A-N, and that is an antibacterial ingredient. And, you know, it's great at killing bacteria, but we're also finding that it is linked to superbugs and creating antibiotic-resistant bacteria. So the Canadian Medical Association has been asking for a ban of this ingredient since 2009, and now Health Canada just came out and said that they're declaring it officially an environmental toxin, and they're still investigating the health links. But either way, I am asking people today to go to their bathrooms and look for that ingredient, triclosan. It could be in your toothpaste. It could be in your deodorant. It could be in your hand soap. It could be an acne wash. So make sure you look at all your ingredients, look for that triclosan, and if you see it in there, get rid of it today. Like I said, I want Canadians to start our own bans as soon as possible, because the federal government, while they're saying it's toxic, they're not actually going to be banning it. They're just asking companies to voluntarily phase it out over time. I'm saying that's not good enough, and we can do this today.
Now, are some germs good for us? And the reason why I bring that up is we now live in a society where everyone's using Purell, and there are some people out there who need a 12-step program, I think.
Yes. We have a deep fear of bacteria in our culture today. And I think, you know what, I blame my my pals in the press, the ones that, who pull out the UV lights and flash them on our sponges and on our, you know, cell phones and terrify us with the bacteria that's around us. And you know what? You're very right. A lot of bacteria is very, you know, we need a good balance of bacteria around us. And in fact, researchers keep finding that you know, kids that grew up on farms exposed to a lot of different bacteria, they have much healthier immune systems than kids who grew up in really sanitized environments where everything was bleached to death and there was no germ left on any surface. And so that's why doctors are saying, listen, you know, let's get rid of the antibacterial soap and just go back to good old-fashioned soap and water, wash your hands for 20 seconds. It gets rid of the bad bacteria, but it doesn't get rid of the good bacteria, because we need that good bacteria to help fight our battles for us and keep us healthy.
I know you talk about reading the labels to make sure that there aren't things in your products that are harmful to us. It's very important for our health, obviously, but for some people, the other thing, too, is just expediency and cost. Looking for things that don't harm us can be sometimes more costly, or is that a misnomer?
You know what? I think that For sure. Some things will cost you more. A natural sunscreen that doesn't have, you know, any chemical ingredients tied to estrogen mimicking, that isn't allergenic, that kind of thing. You know, a natural sunscreen by a company like Green Beaver will cost you more than your conventional sunscreen. But for me, it was really important to do and offer up a lot of do-it-yourself recipes, because in other areas we don't really need to go to the store at all. I you know, when I'm talking across Canada, I always bring up the fact that, you know, we can cut out the chemical middleman and the packaging middleman by making a lot of this stuff ourselves. And you know, I am no Martha Stewart. I don't really like those super ambitious recipes that, you know, take a lot of time. For me, when I'm talking about making yourself, I really am just talking about going to your kitchen and, you know, grabbing a bottle of good quality cooking oil, whether it's sunflower, safflower, grapeseed oil, olive oil, bring that back to your bathroom, and after your shower, putting a little bit of a few drops on as a body moisturizer. If you're shaving your face, after your shower again, put a few drops on your wet face and start shaving with that as a shaving oil instead of shaving cream. In fact, if you go into your drugstore now, you might spot a $5 per ounce shaving oil, when you can just go to your kitchen and get, you know, $5 for a big jug of oil and use that on your face instead. And I talk about the million and one functions of oil in my book, as well as things like honey. You know, honey is amazingly antibacterial. And when scientists compared a tablespoon of dark honey to, you know, over-the-counter cough suppressant that you get from the drugstore, the journal Pediatrics found that the dark honey actually worked better for kids than the over-the-counter, you know, cough suppressant. And so there's so many cases where honey is just beating out some of the products on shelves. In fact, in burn units now, they're testing out Manuka honey because it's great at helping to heal antibiotic-resistant wounds as well as burns. And you know what? We can go straight to nature for pennies. That's what I love about it, too, is there's no packaging involved. There's only one ingredient in there, so we know exactly what's in there. And it costs us next to nothing because it came from our kitchens, which I love. So, you know, I think it balances out. You spend a little bit more on that natural sunscreen, and then you save a lot by doing your own shaving oil, your own shaving cream, your own moisturizer, and, you know, your own polysporin and that kind of thing.
It sounds like mom or grandma were right.
Yeah, you know what? They really were. They really were. And I think, you know, researchers are now realizing that. They're doing the hard science on it and doing the research and finding, wow, they weren't lying all along. You know, they were onto something there, and now we're realizing that, you know what, some of those recipes really were the right way to go.
You use humor in your writing. I'm just wondering if it was a conscious effort to not have people wanting to live in a bubble.
You know what, I think humor for me is just all in the family. I grew up in a family where there was a lot of joking and bantering at the dinner table, and you know, if you wanted to get people's attention, then you had to have it coming out of your mouth in joke form. And so that's you know, just in the family for me. And so it was important to, you know, I think for me, the way I write, I try to write the way I talk with my friends, and so you won't pick up Ecoholic Body and feel like you're reading this, you know, dry, judgmental, knock you over the head kind of stuff. You know, yeah, I do bring up some of the scary facts, and then I tell you some of the great Canadian-based solutions to, you know, that are on hand, and some of the ways you can make yourself. But I always try to do it with, you know, in just a casual conversational style and with a lot of humor, because, you know what, honestly, we've got to get through life with a little humor. It makes everything go down a little easier, don't you think?
Absolutely. We got less than a minute. We didn't even get a chance to talk about stuff that we put on, not just creams and lotions, but clothing.
Yes, okay, yeah. Ecoholic Body is really everything to do with the body inside and out, including your clothes. And now, clothing is an interesting one because our cotton is very pesticide-intensive to grow. But not only that, but a lot of companies are actually finishing the fabric, giving it a nice wrinkle-resistant finish by adding formaldehyde to our clothes. Formaldehyde is a known carcinogen, and that's why some people will bring home clothes and actually get a rash from it. One woman sued Victoria's Secret because her bra made her break out the rash because of the formaldehyde coating on it. So I really encourage people to look for, secondhand fabrics will have much less of that, and that's the cheapest way to go. Looking for some nice eco-friendly organic fabrics when you can afford it. There's some great Montreal designers now working with great recycled, upcycled materials, and as well as eco-fabrics. You guys are lucky, actually. You have the most eco-clothing stores in Canada, I found, right?
Wow.
In Montreal. And I have a directory of those on my website, ecoholic.ca. And, you know, our sandals are leaching. If you've got those cheap plastic sandals, you don't really know what kind of plastic it is. You picked it up at the shopping center. Often it's made with vinyl, and they're leaching phthalates that are banned from baby toys because they're hormone disruptors. Denmark found that they were leaching into kids' feet, and so they're banning them from their country altogether. And I'm still sitting here waiting for Health Canada to make the same move. So in the meantime, I encourage everybody to switch to natural fiber shoes as much as possible, especially for our kids. And if it is a plastic, then make sure it's not vinyl. And if they don't know what kind of plastic it is, then leave it on the shelf. Even a safer EVA plastic would be a better choice for shoes than just kind of one of those mystery plastics that you don't really know too much of what it's made of.
The book is called Ecoholic Body. It's written by Adria Vassil. And Adria, I thank you very, very much for being on the program.
My pleasure. Nice talking to you.
Adria Vassil, author of Ecoholic Body. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0144, and you'll find links to Adria's website. You'll also find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the author of The Statue of Liberty, A Transatlantic Story, plus Edward Mayer, the VP of Exhibits and Archives at Ripley's Believe It or Not. We'll be on to talk about their latest book, which is entitled Unbelievable Stories for Guys. And, of course, we do have an idiot of the day. Stick around for that. But right now, more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. Next time you're sitting around wondering what it would be like to be shot in the leg, 25-year-old Sean Masso of Norfolk, Virginia, is the guy you want to call. Police say Sean's friend asked him to do just that, shoot him in the leg with a rifle, because he wanted to know what it feels like to be shot. So Sean did. Shot him once in the right leg with a .22 caliber rifle. The idiot who asked to be shot is expected to make a full recovery, but police charge Massa with reckless endangerment and is being held at the county jail on $10,000 bail. Now that brings new meaning to the term friendly fire, doesn't it? Two parent chaperones at the Colorado High School prom are in hot water after they sprayed Lysol on students engaged in dirty dancing and call several teenage girls sluts and whores. The bizarre incident last month at the Manitou Springs High School resulted in harassment charges being filed against Jennifer Farmer and Hannah Rocky, both 42-year-old mothers, and who were dressed in combat boots and military fatigues at the time of the incident. Several teenagers told officers that the chaperones subsequently deployed the Lysol, which got into the eyes and mouths of some dancers, some of whom had to leave the prom. Farmer and Rocky were later cited for harassment, but not due to the Lysol, rather for directing obscene language to another in a public place, according to the criminal complaints. Both women have denied the Lysol spraying, which seems rather bold considering the tons of student witnesses on hand. You know, it might have been, you know, much more effective and not as dangerous to just flick on the house lights and kill the music every time the dirty dancing started. That'll stop that stuff real quick. However, you have to wonder just how premeditated this whole thing was. I mean, if you're a chaperone and you show up in combat boots and military fatigues, and you're packing Lysol, you must have plans. Anyway. Well, you could say at least he went out happy. In El Paso, Texas, 67-year-old Robert Gene White had a heart attack and died while he received several lap dances at the Red Parrot Strip Club. When it came time to pay up, the dancers discovered him unresponsive. Employees unsuccessfully tried to perform CPR. El Paso County Sheriff's deputies told the station that there were no immediate signs of foul play, but the investigation is still open. And you know, no amount of work by the mortician is going to get the smile off his face. Moving right along, the good news is your boy did his homework. The bad news is he left it at the crime scene. In Orem, Utah, 18-year-old Dallas Naljahi was arrested on suspicion of burglary after police tracked a flash drive he apparently left at the home that he allegedly burglarized. The drive contained his school homework and was found in a backpack abandoned in the backyard. The home's 75-year-old male resident says he was awakened by a light in his office and found a man who was looking through a desk. The suspect punched the man and fled on foot. Police say that Dallas was found asleep at his house along with evidence connecting him to the burglary. Dude, you punched an old man. A 75-year-old man. Seriously? Marks off for that, even if you did do your homework. Australian Olympic shooting gold medalist Russell Mark will be making quite an entrance at the upcoming Summer Olympic Games in London. Having lost a bet, Mark is set to parade during the opening ceremony wearing a lime green mankini, you know, the kind made famous by the movie character Borat. Mark, who won double trap gold at the 96 Olympic Games and silver in Sydney, pledged to wear the skimpy swimsuit if Melbourne-based Carlton lost to St. Kilda in the Australian Football League. Carlton suffered a shock 4-goal defeat in the match, and Mark owned up by making the bet on a local radio. At age 48, this will be Mark's 6th Olympics, and he has a chance of being named flag bearer. So all of you out there watching television at the Olympics, set your DVRs. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, with only 30,000 hotel rooms in Rio de Janeiro and 50,000 visitors expected for the June United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development, officials persuaded owners of many of the city's short-term love hotels, typically rented for 4 hours at a time, to change business plans for a few days to accommodate the delegates. A BBC News stringer reported that the hotels will remove some special fixtures and furniture, such as erotic chairs and velvet wall coverings, but that the large round beds would stay. Fortunately, the conference does not begin until June 13th. The night of June 12th, which is Lover's Day, is a big income producer for short-stay hotels. What they're really going to need is a hazmat team to clean those rooms up in time. That's what they're going to need. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? The Statue of Liberty is an American symbol that almost everyone in the world is familiar with. Many also know that Lady Liberty was a gift from France. But what is the story about her creation and her arrival on U.S. soil? Well, Edward G. Berenson is the author of The Statue of Liberty, A Transatlantic Story, and he joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Edward.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for being on the program with us. Everyone, as I say, knows the Statue of Liberty, but they don't know the story behind it. What was it about the story that made you say, I've got to share it?
Well, a lot of it has to do with French politics to begin with. There was an effort on the part of some French dissidents who were Tocquevillians to criticize their government. Their government was run by Napoleon III. It was a dictatorship. And they had a hard time speaking out in public because there was so much censorship. And so what they wanted to do was to compare their dictatorship with what they considered to be a much better government, the United States government. And they wanted to do that by offering a gift to the United States that would emphasize American liberty as opposed to what they believed was French tyranny. And one of the main people behind this was a man named Edouard de Laboulaye, who was a professor and an expert on the United States, and another was Frédéric Bartholdi, who was the sculptor of the Statue of Liberty. And so the idea was born out of a French political conflict.
Okay, so as you say, it was a dictatorship, basically, at the time. The Statue of Liberty is kind of large and would take some time to make. How does something like that get out of France if it's run by a dictatorship to sort of snub the nose at the French way of political life?
Right, and so that's why the French had a really hard time getting it off the ground, and in fact it didn't get going until after the dictatorial regime of Napoleon III fell in 1870, and as a result of the Franco-Prussian War, and then there was a new government, and this government was a republic that resembled more the American government. And when that new French republic got off the ground, it became possible to build the thing. The problem is, when Bartholdi, the sculptor, came over to the United States to try to sell the idea, nobody in the U.S. was interested. They thought, well, we didn't do this sort of thing. We didn't build giant statues. And this is a French thing. It referred back to ancient Greece and Rome, and Americans weren't doing that kind of thing in the 19th century either. And so most people Bartholdi met with in the early 1870s when he came here to try to push his idea, they didn't respond to it at all. And it took him about 6 years to sell the idea to the United States. And even then, the American government didn't agree to put up any funds, nor, by the way, did the French government. And so it's not strictly speaking accurate to say that the Statue of Liberty was a gift from France to the United States, because the two governments had nothing to do with it. It was rather a gift on the part of French private citizens who raised the money privately to the United States as private citizens, who raised the money privately for the pedestal. The French paid for the statue, and American private contributions paid for the pedestal.
So from the time that it was first planned, the idea was first hatched, to the time that the Statue of Liberty was standing where it is right now, how long of a time frame was that?
21 years.
Wow.
So the idea was first germinated in 1865. It wasn't unveiled in New York Harbor until 1886. But one of the things that isn't too well known on this side of the Atlantic is that the Statue of Liberty was fully assembled in Paris and stood there for 2 years before it was disassembled and shipped over to the United States. And one reason why it stood for 2 years in Paris is that the Americans were having a hard time coming up with money to pay for the pedestal. So it took the French around 6 years to raise the money for the statue itself. And they put the whole thing together over the space of several years in a part of Paris that was just beyond the main part of the city, and it stood there. And it's you can see these amazing photographs of the Statue of Liberty going up in Paris. And when I tell Americans that this was the case, you know, most people had no idea that the Statue of Liberty stood up in Paris for a long time. Then it was dismantled. Each individual part was numbered, and it was packed into 212 shipping containers, put on a boat, and crossed the Atlantic and landed in the spring of 1885 on the little island where it is now, Bedloe's Island, and it sat there unpacked for a long time before the Americans came up with the money to raise the pedestal. And the reason why we came up with that money is that the newspaper man, Joseph Pulitzer, put out a subscription drive to his readers, and he used this whole populist campaign. He said, look, the moneyed people of New York, any one of them, if they wanted to, the Vanderbilts and people like that, they could have paid for the pedestal, but they're too cheap, and in fact, maybe they didn't even like the symbolism of liberty. So why don't we, the ordinary people, come up with the money? And that's what happened. Just regular people sent in nickels, dimes, quarters, dollars in a few cases, and 100,000 and more than 100,000 people raised about $100,000 in the space of a few months, and that's what made it possible to come up with the money to pay for the pedestal to build the Statue of Liberty.
How was it decided as far as the location was concerned?
Well, that was the sculptor, Bartholdi. He came over here, and got to keep in mind, here's a guy, he doesn't speak a word of English, he doesn't know anybody in the United States, and he lands here in the fall of 1871, and he looks around, and he decides it's got to be in New York, because New York is the main port of the United States, and the first place he looks is Central Park, which at that point was way, way, way outside the city, and he thought this isn't going to work because people aren't going to go see it, and then he thought the Battery, but there were some all buildings already down there, and he thought that it might be overshadowed, and then he noticed this little speck of land, then called Bedloe's Island, right at the end of the Narrows, the part where the New York Harbor narrows and then widens into the port, a little speck of land where there was a military fort, and he thought, this would be the place where I've got to put the Statue of Liberty, because of the Narrows. Every ship that comes into New York has to come very close to this island, and he thought anybody who was coming to the United States by boat would have to practically just about touch the Statue of Liberty. And so he was convinced that's where it needed to go, but he had to get the permission of the American government because there was a military fort there, and he finally got that permission, but he didn't get Congress to put up any money. That the original idea was that Congress was going to contribute $100,000, and that actually got voted down. And then the state of New York was supposed to contribute about $50,000. And you got to think that this is, you know, in the 1870s, so it's worth a lot more money nowadays. And the governor at the time, a man named Grover Cleveland, who would become president, of course, he vetoed the $50,000 appropriation. So the American governments weren't very cooperative at first. But once the Statue of Liberty got off the ground, and when it went up in Paris and there were photographs of it, there were illustrations of it, all kinds of illustrated weekly newspapers and magazines were coming into being at that time. And so that's what I think convinced Americans in the United States that the Statue of Liberty was something they should want, because they were so amazed by the pictures they saw of the Statue of Liberty as it was going up, and then finally when it stood in Paris, that I think that's what convinced people that we had to have it here.
Okay, we have just about a minute, and I have to ask this question. I mean, I know a lot of artists, be it they sculptors or painters, usually have a model. Do we know who the Statue of Liberty's model is, or was there one?
We don't exactly know. For a long time, historians thought it was the sculptor's mother. But we're pretty sure that's not true, because he was very close to his mother. He wrote her just about every day, and it's pretty clear that if she had been the model, he would have told her so, and he didn't. And so historians tend to think that it was just some anonymous woman who posed for Bartholdi. We don't know her name. And in fact, the model was the subject of a musical in 1949 called Miss Liberty, which was this popular Broadway show. And the plot revolved around different journalists trying to discover who was the model for the Statue of Liberty. In fact, we don't know.
Fascinating story indeed. The book is called The Statue of Liberty, A Transatlantic Story. It's written by Edward G. Berenson. And Edward, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Edward G. Berenson, author of The Statue of Liberty, A Transatlantic Story. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0144, and you'll find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. According to a census expert, the population of California just reached 38 million people. About 12% of Americans now live in the Golden State. California leads the nation in many things, including the number of lawsuits. According to one report, nearly 40% of all lawsuits filed under the Americans with Disabilities Act are filed in California. Last year, I told you about how this law is being twisted by judges to do things that were never intended. Small businesses can now lose thousands of dollars fighting lawsuits over a railing height being a few centimeters off, or a parking lot stripe not being the right shade of a certain color. Let's be fair, the problem there has become so bad that support for cracking down on these frivolous lawsuits is now getting strong bipartisan support. A bill aimed at eliminating predatory ADA lawsuits recently received equal votes from both parties in committee, providing hope for an end to the lawsuit culture that has plagued the Golden State for so long. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
From Montreal, Canada, and spanning the globe like a butterfly on speed, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Edward Mayer from Ripley's Believe It or Not. Plus, we have, of course, an idiot of the day. But right now, more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. In San Diego, a 43-year-old woman had to undergo surgery on her leg after rocks collected by her children at Trestles Beach spontaneously combusted in her pocket. During their beach visit, her children had collected seven unusual-looking rocks, orange and green in color, and the woman had put them in her right pocket of her cargo pants. Captain Mark Stone, a spokesperson for the Orange County Fire Authority, said the woman began to feel intense heat emanating from her pocket as she was standing in the kitchen of her home. Her clothing and skin began to burn as the heat intensified, and she also suffered second-degree burns on her hand as she tried to remove the rocks from her pocket. Her husband also suffered second-degree burns to his hand as he tried to help her. Eventually, she managed to remove the shorts, but the rocks burned right through the fabric and continued to smolder on the kitchen floor. They have a wooden floor. Filling the home with smoke. Captain Stone said authorities were conducting tests on the collected rocks, but results were not expected for a couple of weeks. He added, "There is phosphorus that naturally occurs on the sand at the beach, but no one has ever heard of pants catching fire." Now, I know this story happened, and I do believe her, but don't you just have the urge to say, liar, liar, pants on fire? Don't you? Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. In Ramsey, Minnesota, police arrested Alan Petrusen after he allegedly tied himself to a tree, put a blindfold on, exposed his genitals, and simply waited for anonymous sex. This all went down close to a public park, and Ramsey Police Chief James Way said, "It's the weirdest thing I've heard of out there." Mr. Petrusen claims he was just sleeping, but Chief Way said, "No way," doesn't buy it, and says, "That's up to the judge and or a jury to determine if it gets that far." Meanwhile, Petrusen faces charges of indecent exposure, lewd conduct, and trespassing, since the tree he was allegedly tied to was not on park property. You know, he might just get that anonymous sex he's looking for in jail, but that's a whole other story. Anyway, on to our last guest here on the Stuff File program. The folks at Ripley's Believe It or Not have come out with a new book. This one is called Unbelievable Stories for Guys. And on the line with us right now to share what you'll find between the covers of this new tome is Edward Mayer, the VP of Exhibits and Archives from Ripley's Believe It or Not. Hi, Edward.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, this new book, The title is Stories for Guys. So I have to ask right off the bat, are women allowed to read this?
Absolutely. You know, I didn't come up with the title. In your introduction there, you correctly pointed out that I'm VP of Exhibits, but I'm also on the editorial staff of our book program, and that's sort of why you're talking to me today. I think that these are stories for anybody who doesn't necessarily like to read novels. Okay? They're short, one paragraph, two pages at absolute most stories that are all unbelievable, all true, but not necessarily all new. This book is a little different than our other books in that it really represents a best of Ripley's. We've gone through our archives with a fine tooth and just said, hey, you know, this story's from 1937, but it's still amazing. Or this story's from just 6 weeks ago, but this has got to go in the book. So it's a wider range than we've typically done in our books. But we've told a bit more of the story so you get the facts behind the Believe It or Not, but still kept it short enough that you can pick up, read one page, put it down, go to work, come back, and read another page tonight. You know?
Short attention span reading, so it definitely is for guys.
Well, that I think is what we thought, but you said it more succinctly than I did. You know, it really is for the person that doesn't like to read in long spurts. You know, it's meant to be read 10 minutes here, 15 minutes there. But I think women will like most of the stories. There's clearly some stuff that is very guy-centric. Sections on, you know, FBI, CIA, not my cup of tea, but I'd say they're definitely male-oriented. And there's some sports stuff. But really, the overall theme is just unbelievable. And it's the kind of thing that we thought that teenage boys might really, really like, and therefore say, hey, Mom, why don't you buy this for Father's Day? And then Dad gets to read it, and then he gets to read it when Dad's finished.
Well, it's funny you mentioned teenage boys, because the one thing teenage boys and even younger boys will do is they will dare each other to do certain things. So there are certain stories in the book, I understand. Like, for instance, the Russian who put his head in a particle accelerator. Now that sounds almost like a dare.
Well, the story behind the story, and first off, I must say it is a survival story. Ripley's can get a little gruesome sometimes, but we do try to have a happy ending to the nasty stories. And this is a would-be nuclear physicist doing a brave stunt as opposed to a stupid stunt that he realized that he'd screwed up and there was imminent danger to several people, and he threw himself on the line, literally sacrificed, knowing that, you know, it was going to potentially kill him, but he was going to save some other people in the process. As it turned out, it literally melted most of his face off, but he not only survived, he went on to get his PhD, he went on to be a renowned nuclear physicist who's done a lot of good for the world, though severely scarred.
Wow. Isn't that how Spock died in Star Trek 2?
Don't do this at home.
Yeah. Isn't that how Spock died in Star Trek 2?
I believe. I don't know about Star Trek 2, but it was a Star Trek type thing.
Yeah. Okay. Now, what about the corpse farm in Tennessee? What exactly is a corpse farm?
Well, I've actually been to this site, so I think I can explain this one pretty good. It is a forensic working lab. This is where all those people we watch every night on CSI TV shows that have all the cool toys and are able to figure out anything and everything. Well, this is a real place for that kind of person. They bury bodies, they hide them under leaves, they put them in the trunks of cars, and would-be forensic experts study the remains in order to determine how long they've been dead, what killed them, how'd the body get to where it was, etc. And it's a working laboratory that is a really interesting place to experience.
With all the stuff that you have at Ripley's, and as I mentioned in the introduction, you are the VP of Exhibits and Archives, so you know where everything is and what everything is. Is it really difficult to put stories in this book when you have so much to choose from?
Well, I think the real answer is no. It just means that we'll always have a volume 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I mean, there's a wealth of material. There's about 500 stories in this book alone. You know, it's a 256-page book. It's not a little bit of fluff. And, you know, I would like to think that there's new stuff happening, as well as if we have to, we go back into the archives for some old stuff. But as long as people are out there curious, doing strange things, there's always going to be a room for another Ripley's book.
With all the stuff that you know and you do...
The hard part is picking what's best.
Right.
You know?
With all the stuff that you know and you do, what, for you, is hard to believe?
Well, I have all kinds of favorites from this book. Page 115 talks about a guy named Mirin Dejo who could put a saber, you know, a fencing foil, through his stomach, all the way through, and then walk around as if there was nothing happened. You know, imagine Steve Martin with that arrow in his head, but this is a real sword through the guy's abdomen. And no scientist at the time was able to explain it. He not only didn't bleed, he didn't feel any pain, and, you know, he could do it repeatedly. On request, sure, I'll put the sword through me.
How does a guy even know that he can do that the first time? That's what I want to know.
That is the great question. I'm glad I'm not the only one that asked that. I have never understood how you discover you can swallow swords. That, to me, is one of the great mysteries of the world. I once met a gentleman named Brad Byers who, for several years, had the record for swallowing the most swords at one time. The other record for sword swallowers, of course, is the longest sword. But Brad Byers was a circus juggler. He walked into an army surplus store on a dare, knowing that the sword swallower in the circus earned almost twice what he did as a juggler. He said, well, I'm going to learn how to swallow swords so I can earn some more money. He took a sword off the wall in the army surplus store, shoved it down his throat. Hurt himself considerably, but realized what he had done right and what he had done wrong, and within 6 months, he was the world champion sword swallower.
Okay, see, that's what makes him different from most of us, because you make that mistake once, you realize what you've done wrong, you figure, okay, I don't really need to do this twice.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't even do it the first time, but yeah, that's... So, you know, that's the only sword swallower I've ever asked, how do you do it? And his story just, you know, cause more questions than answers. But, you know, you're right. How do you find out you can put a sword through your stomach or down your throat? It's just such a big risk. You know, why would you do it?
As you mentioned, this book is a great idea for Father's Day, and it is available in both hardcover and ebook versions. And people can find out more information by going to the Ripley's website. They could also go to Amazon.com, and it's available, as you said, just in time for Father's Day, correct?
Well, that's our marketing ploy. We really believe this is a good read for men, and dad is so much harder to buy for the mom that, you know, maybe someone in the family will say, hey, Dad, you always like Ripley's. This is the book for you.
Excellent. Edward, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Edward Mayer from Ripley's Believe It or Not. The book is Unbelievable Stories for Guys, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0144, and you'll find links to Ripley's website. You'll also find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Two budding burglars in Colima, Colombia are learning the hard way that Facebook and crime don't mix. It seems the two aspiring criminals robbed an internet cafe at gunpoint recently and proceeded to make a clean getaway on a motorcycle. It may have appeared to be the perfect crime, except for one thing. They forgot to log out of the Facebook account that he checked in on at the cafe before attempting the robbery. As you might expect, the police got his address, drove to the criminal's home, and took the suspect to jail. The rise of Facebook seems to have coincided with an increased number of reports of dumb thieves. In December, Isaiah Cutler was accused of burglarizing a market in Pittsburgh with three teens, then posting pictures on his Facebook page showing the suspects mugging and showing off some of the loot. And you may remember just last month we told you about Michael Baker of Jenkins, Kentucky, who was arrested for siphoning gas from a police car after he posted a picture of himself committing the crime on Facebook. Facebook. The new IPO makes it easy to be an IOD because anybody who would include Facebook in connection to their crime is an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0144. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0144. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, God. I always screw it up.